This is another episode of Connecting the Dots podcast. I'm Skip Stewart, Vice President and Chief Improvement Officer at Baptist Memorial Healthcare.
Hey, everybody. I'm HF Mason. I'm Chief Medical Officer at Baptist Memorial Hospital DeSoto and Chief Quality Officer for the Baptist System.
And hi, everyone. I'm Jake Lancaster. I'm an internal medicine physician and the Chief Medical Information Officer for the Baptist System.
Well, today we are so excited. We have Todd Rogers. And Todd Rogers is a professor of public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. But just as important, he's also the author of a fascinating new book called Writing for Busy Readers, Writing for Busy Readers. But before we jump into the book and the research, Todd, if you would quickly tell our listeners a little bit about you and your background.
Thanks, Skip, for having me, and thanks, team, for having me. Really excited to be on this podcast with you. I am a behavioral scientist, so I do randomized controlled trials, testing different ways to communicate with people. I've worked on voter mobilization and persuasion, fundraising, schools and absenteeism, even on nutrition and other kind of things in that domain. So I work on the science of how do we write so busy people read, understand, and respond to what we write.
Todd, once again, thank you very much for being here. And when I found out you were going to be on the podcast, I looked at your website. I haven't read your book yet, but I've ordered it.
What?
I know. I'm so sorry.
But it's too long.
That's one of the jokes. We know one of the principles is write less, and we wrote a 200-page book about it.
But you know, the concept is fascinating, and you know, one thing that I've learned already is you talk about beautiful writing versus effective writing, and I just equated them both, that if you could write eloquently, that was effective writing. But talk to us a little bit about the difference.
Sure. I want to go back. Look, you do surgery, I'll write books, and we'll keep the balance. It's okay to have not read the book, but here's the TLDR version of the whole thing, the too long, didn't read version, is if we make it easy for our readers, we will be more effective in having them read, understand, and respond. It's also kinder to them. It's also more inclusive and accessible, because sometimes we write in ways that require quite a bit of education to understand. But your narrow question, which I took a broad lens on, is, so the difference between writing well and writing effectively. Writing well is what your high school English teacher taught you to do, which is grammatically correct, active verbs, beautiful, almost artistical writing. And that stuff's great for recreational reading if you want it. But I write often practically. I write to someone asking them to update them or to motivate them or to ask them to take some action. And you probably do too. It could be we text message with our family or our patients or our students. We write emails, we write reports, we write proposals or evaluations. Those are practical writing. And the goal there is to effectively achieve our goals. And it turns out the easier we make it for our reader, the more likely they will be to actually help us achieve our goal, which is to be understood.
I like how you said, you know, the easier it would be for our reader. You know, it's like we would have to put more effort into the writing to make it easier for them. And, you know, I forgot who said it. Maybe it was Churchill. Everything is attributed to Churchill, but you know, it was like, I'm sorry for the long speech, I didn't have time to make it shorter, or something like that. You know, and Skip and I would, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you got it. Although I've never heard it to Churchill, it's Twain or Einstein. It was actually, yeah, Blaise Pascal, and
okay,
a French polymath in the 17th century. But that's exactly right. But you said Churchill. I just last week discovered a memo that Churchill wrote in the summer of 1940, where London is being bombed during the Blitzkrieg, right? They call it the Battle, mm-hmm, of Britain. He writes a memo to his staff entitled Brevity. The first sentence is, in order to do our jobs, we have to read too much. And then he proceeds to say, it's important for winning the war that we write in a way that makes it easy for us to read what we're sending to each other. And I've started opening, like, okay, he's trying to win a war. I'm trying to get people to respond to my email. But I mean, turns it out it's the same principles.
Yeah, and Skip and I were also talking about, I mean, earlier in the week, I got an email that was 4 or 5 paragraphs long, and I glanced at that, realized how much effort it's going to take me, how much time to read that whole thing, digest it, and come up with a response. And so immediately I flagged that as something I will come back to when I have the time. And sometimes I never do, you know, or I need to be reminded to do it. And just because just looking at it is so intimidating sometimes.
Exactly. So the way Jessica Lasky Fink is my co-author on this book, the way we think about it is there are multiple steps for effective communication. Step one is that the reader chooses to engage with what we wrote. And in that story you were just telling, you didn't even get past step one, which is I looked at it, I'm like, nah, not now. Sometime later, and later often never comes. Step two is conditional on engaging. You actually read it. And then the problem is you're going to give up. You're going to skim. You're going to conclude that the wrong thing because you're trying to skim it. And then the third and final one is whether you take the action that is being requested. But I what you're saying, this sort of whether we engage or not is also just like pretty straightforward. We all have this experience, even with our cell phones, where we look at a text message and even the shortest mode of communication we send each other, I look at it like, nah, can't deal with that right now.
Yeah. Or you start to read it and then you get interrupted by something else and you go do that thing and then you come back to it. I forgot, I don't know the current statistic, but it was something like our attention span has regressed from 13 seconds to 8 seconds before we lose our attention. And it just keeps going down in the age of Twitter and all these notifications.
Well, and that was going to be my next question is, how much has the digital age contributed to this, Todd? Because are we all just becoming a population of skimmers? You know, that's all we're going to do. And this is so necessary that we embrace communicating more effectively, shorter, more succinct, or we're just not going to be able to communicate at all.
Yeah, we will get into the 6 principles of writing effectively, the sort of pragmatics of it. But at this level, the metaphor that I like to think of is we've got the Eastern gray squirrel, right? And it is trying to decide, its goal is to survive and procreate. But let's just think about its survival goal. This sounds absolutely absurd. I swear it's going to be something that's directly related to digital life, which is it has to make this decision. How long do I continue to exploit the current niche that I'm in for food, right? And there's tons of, like, every animal goes through this process of how long do I stay here versus explore new niches? How long do I exploit this niche before exploring other niches? And the criteria for that, which we see, like, the same mathematical model describes our explore-exploit trade-offs across every category of human thinking, of every animal we know. It's some combination of how much more rewarding is this current activity going to be, and how costly do I expect it to be to find another niche? How long is it going to take? What's the probability of it being there? How rich is it going to be relative to this niche? And one thing that the digital age has done, I don't even know whether our cognitive abilities have changed. There is talk of this, but I'm not really sure. But what is true is that the switching costs, the exploration costs have gone down dramatically. It used to be that I'm reading something, and in order to read something else, I have to put it down, go search for it, grab it, read it. So the exploration cost is much higher. So I'm going to exploit what I'm reading now a little bit longer, which is like I devote a little bit more of my limited attention to it, read it a little bit more closely. Now, as soon as I'm like, I'm not really sure, this is not that valuable, the cost is so low to go into the next thing. It's just delete or click the next thing. And so what's happened in our world is like the switching costs have gone down so low that the moment you lose someone's attention, this is true in video, this is true in writing, the moment you lose their attention or audio, this podcast, the moment we lose their attention, the switching costs are really low and they're just going to jump to another thing.
No, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about switching costs, and you know, it makes sense now when people say if you want to get something done, put your phone far away in the room where you have to go walk to it in order to get it, to kind of increase, I guess, some of that switching costs. But I want to dive into your principles. You know, one of my issues is, and Skip brought this up before we started recording, is that doctors, whenever we see a patient, we tend to write a note about the patient to send for billing or to communicate with others or for help us remember later. Some physicians write really short, great notes. Some write incredibly long, detailed notes. Some copy forward every history detail ever documented about that patient in existence into a new note, creating a note that's about 100 pages long.
You're not talking about surgeons.
No, surgeons, yeah. Bone broke, we'll fix. That's their note. But a lot of others, we have an issue with it in medicine. And it makes it very hard to find the relevant information with those long, detailed notes. But maybe we can talk about your principles on how to write effective communication in that context.
Yeah, I think it starts with what we call principle zero is – you can't write effectively without knowing what your goal is. And I actually think as you were describing that, I have many of my friends are physicians, family members, they work in healthcare in some way. It's not clear. I'm wondering, given I don't know what the actual use of different notes are, but learning a lot about the malpractice system, it seems totally conceivable that the note process is a CYA for eventual lawsuits, in which case a 5-word sentence as your only note may look to a jury like you were inattentive, and a 100-page note may look like you were incredibly responsive and thoughtful and devoted. I say that only as, okay, so let's say that the goal is actually not defensive medicine, mm-hmm. but actually improving the quality of care. And if that's the case, then I assume the goal of the note is to allow the next physician who reviews this record to be able to quickly pull useful information that's relevant to whatever they're considering at present. And if that's the case, then it's all the detail that's necessary and no more. But then within that constraint, you want to write it so it's easy to read. And I know, this is a completely unrealistic way of writing for specifically notes in health records, because I know how these things are produced. But if you were going to write several paragraphs, you'd want to make it skimmable. You'd want to add structure. So like one of the experiments that Jessica and I ran was we had someone sending 50,000 journalists a 6-paragraph note or a 6-paragraph note with headings every couple paragraphs. And we found that it more than doubled the percent of journalists who used anything past the second paragraph when you put headings in, because it just makes it way easier to navigate. You don't even have to cut content. It's just adding structure makes it easier for someone jumping around to navigate. But again, like it depends on your goals. And I worry that the goals are competing in some sense in the health record context. What do you think? Am I reading it right?
Yeah, part of our issue is also multiple different audiences for each note. Like I mentioned, it may be for CYA, it may be for billing, it may be for other providers, it may be for yourself. Now it's even going to the patient. And so you got a lot of different audiences with the same note. And some physicians just find it, you know, it's much easier, again, to write a long note than a short informative note, and we are very pressed for time, and so that's why I think a lot of the length happens is they don't want to take the time to create a good one.
If the goal is to make it easier for the next physician to review this and pull useful information relevant to the present things being considered, then you would do a final round of edit. And I know let's imagine you're going to do multiple rounds of edits on your notes, but like you do a final round of edit where you ask yourself, how do I make it easier for the next reader? And just through that lens, you'd add structure. Maybe you delete completely gratuitous components. But that's the idea. The idea is, and maybe this is a tough context, but it does start with being clear on what your goal is.
Talk to us about some of the other principles. You know, give us some teasers. We want people to read your book and all that, but give us a little bit more.
Harvey, I want to start with getting you to read the book.
Sure, absolutely. I'm going to. I promise.
Sure. The audiobook also has an amazing voice, I'm told, that that reading it, it's melodious. Okay. It sounds almost exactly like this one. The other principles, like the idea here is everything's the goal is to write so that it's easier for people to read and that's more effective. And then the question is how. And one of the principles is less is more. We've actually run these experiments where one of the large federal political parties with 700,000 donors, we arbitrarily delete every other paragraph from their fundraising messages so that they're like incoherent. And still, by cutting them in half, increase donations. One is less is more in terms of words. The other is in terms of requests. When you ask people to do multiple things, you decrease the likelihood they'll do any one of them because they get distracted, they get derailed. That's one principle. Another principle is make it easy to read. So that is shorter words, common words, shorter sentences, more grammatical simplicity. We ran an experiment with Vice President Kamala Harris when she was the Attorney General in California, where we rewrote these state mandated language like disclosures for parents to when kids had missed school. And we rewrote them so they were not written in legalese. They were written for just people to read. They went from like very high reading level to fifth grade reading level. And then we ran a randomized control trial with 100,000 families and found that writing it so that it was easy to read made it 40% more effective. So the second one is, in that vein, we also worked with the Washington Post and Upworthy and ran 31,000 experiments on headlines for a same story. And the simpler the language in the headline, the more likely people were to click on them. So the idea there is first, less is more. The second is make reading easy. That's another one. And they're all going to be like, I don't know there's some like musical metaphor where it's like they're all riffs on the same theme or like melodies on the same, or you know, I don't know. What is the expression? They're all, I don't know.
In harmony, but anyway, I don't know.
so another one that I think is just generally and universally true. My field and Jessica's field, we're kind of a cross between behavioral economics and social psychology. And you can see behavioral economics and collaborators. We have had a bunch of impact on medication adherence. And I've written the piece in JAMA about how to get people to like take their meds. But the big principle of behavioral, like the most powerful thing in behavioral economics is if you want people to do something, reduce the friction. If you want people to do it, make it easy.
Oh yeah.
If you pre-populate forms, they're more likely to do it. If you reduce the number of steps, they're more likely to do it. If you make all the key information next to each other, they're more likely to use it.
So let me jump in here. We always tell our guests that this podcast is as if we're all sitting at a really nice coffee shop and having a conversation. And I have so many questions that I'm trying to pick which ones do I want to, because I'm so fascinated with this research. So let me throw a presupposition at you, and you tell me if your research doesn't support that or kind of where you're at. But I was recently putting together a newsletter, and most people, I always like to joke and say most people don't want to call their baby ugly. I understand that's probably not the best analogy, but so mothers, please don't get upset with me. But, this newsletter, I remember thinking, I thought it was fantastic, right? It was one page and it was all 12 font and looked great to me. And the very first thing when I handed it to a friend was, no one will ever read this. I was like, what do you mean? It's only one page. you know, and this friend and another friend helped me not only reduce the words, but increase different elements of the font and make it a really attractive, pretty document. And then all of a sudden, this experiment was short, you know, a small sample, you know, but then I had all of this positive feedback of loving this newsletter. We had it very graphically appealing to the eye. We had certain elements where the font was bigger, so it was kind of popping out at you. Even for someone that, like myself, I'm dyslexic, it wouldn't take very long to read it at all. Have you learned anything in that regard, that when you're using the right words with very few words, but it's appealing on the page, it's going to attract the reader, it feels like. But am I way off? What's your thoughts, Todd?
Yeah, I mean, your question about how do we write so it's easier for our readers to pull out the key information, that's the entire gist of the book. You listed a few ways that you made it easier in your newsletter. We actually, in the book, talk about, we work with a healthcare system and their communications to their staff. And we use these, we talk about some examples of changes that we made in their communications to their full staff throughout the medical system. And the example there is, like, there's, you talk about fewer words. Okay. Simpler reading. Okay. Using the structure to make it easy to navigate for a skimmer. That can often mean bullet points. It can often mean headings. It can often mean, like you were describing, maybe a font size change or some other like visual cue about how to navigate this document, making it easier. I think all those are right. It all starts with what's our goal. And if our goal is really to have people be able to understand it, then I think the most important thing is to add structure. And this is what, like, I don't know if you send out to your teams these sort of like, we have 4 points that we need to really drive home right now. And then your newsletter, you might have had that. If you have like a full paragraph talking about what a great month it's been and how we've all done such a good job and the weather has been great and our patient care score, our patient satisfaction scores have been going, like, you're already losing people if you really intended to drive home the 4 points. And so you start with your priorities and then you structure it so that it's easier for readers. If you wanted, on my website, we trained OpenAI's GPT-4, the large language model, on the principles and then tuned it for email. So we pre-post emails. We have 100,000 users on this thing that we put out a couple months ago, which is basically just like you could paste an email and it rewrites it so that it's what would it look like if it was designed to be read by busy skimmers. It's on our website, writingforbusyreaders.com.
So let me make sure I understand that, because that was really good. Because one of the things I was about to jump in, and you kind of beat me to that thought process, is I think, I know this could be controversial with some, but I think that even the very basic free version of ChatGPT, I think that AI can be a great thought partner. And I know that I'll put a sentence sometimes in ChatGPT, and I'll say, how would this sound better? And I may go through 10 iterations of try again, try again. Is that kind of what you're doing there on the website, or tell me a little more about that?
So we're using the underlying, like the most advanced version of the underlying large language model that OpenAI has, which is GPT-4. And we trained it on the principle. So when I give you my bio, I'll also give you a checklist. We have a checklist, which is a one pager. And then we trained it on the checklist. Then we fed it pre and post examples of badly written, skimmable, badly written, skimmable. So it knows how the principles apply to email. And we've been working with a federal agency on rewriting grant application requests. But that's not email. So this is trained for email. You paste your email and then it rewrites it. We have a Chrome extension that people use in Gmail too. It rewrites it according to the principle so that it's skimmable. So the question people ask about AI is like, well, how does AI like sort of obviate or like undermine the need to even learn how to write? And our take is that if you want humans to read it, And, you know, especially the direction that some of my colleagues and yours are working on, like, you know, something like your notes. It's possible we're going to get to a place where we don't want humans. We don't need humans to read it. But if we want the humans to read it, this is what makes it easier and more likely that the human will read it. And so whether you are writing it yourself or your AI is writing it or you're writing it with the assistance of an AI, to the extent that it is for a human to consume, this is how you write so it's more likely the human will consume it.
Skip, I don't know if you remember, but after we visited Rush the summer before last, their data scientist, I can't remember what his name was, but there were some emails back and forth. And at the bottom of his emails, it was always, you know, little, why is this email 5 sentences or less? And I don't know if you've ever seen that. If you Google why, you know, there's a little thing that you can attach to the bottom of your emails. And you know, and sure enough, any email that he ever sent, it was 5 sentences or less. And, you know, I found that kind of fascinating because, you know, sometimes it's just better to pick up the phone and make a phone call, you know. I don't know. Is there any validity to that 5 sentences or less, you know?
Oh, I love that. I just went to it. That's awesome. I think it's, you know, it's 70% of the way that I would say it needs to go, which is there isn't an ironclad law about any of this.
Sure.
It all fits on context, norms, expectations. I tell this story a lot about, I have a student who works for the CIA and he writes intelligence assessments. They have to be 70 pages in his group. And if you write less, I mean, you guys write, I'm sure you do depositions, similar thing. Like they have to conform to whatever the expectation is,
sure,
of what they're supposed to look like. Or you go for reinsurance reimbursements and appeals. They have to look like they're expected. You can't just all of a sudden write them half as long as they're expected to be, even though it took you more time, because the expectation, it has to conform to what people expect. And so we wrote a 200-page book. But we also wrote a one-pager that you're going to have on your show notes. But a book needs to look like a book. And, you know, intelligence assessment needs to look like intelligence assessment. So, yes, 5 sentences for an email sounds awesome. In my lab, we have a rule that no email can be more than 4 sentences. And I've never seen what you just sent me.
Okay.
But the rule on that, Harvey, just like very narrowly, the rule that we have on that is you can attach – whatever you want, or say below, you will see much more detail or whatever. But the idea is we want someone opening it to know exactly what this is, and then they can decide whether they want, how they want to engage more deeply. Sorry, go ahead.
Really, really good. James, you know, that's a great point, Dr. Mason. James Clear, the author of Atomic Habits, talks a little bit about that. He puts an email out every week and he'll have something like 3 quotes or 3. I mean, they're so short that it literally takes no time to read. So you would think that he's thinking about this same kind of thought process. You know, the other thing that's interesting, Todd, is beautiful language, right? There's some books that I've read where either because they're telling a story or they really worked hard to choose just the right words, that it doesn't feel like a long book. And then there's other books where the subject may be correct, but you just feel like you're just going through mud, treading through. I don't know if there's any behavioral insight that you've learned in that process, but there's something there with people that can write beautiful and say something in very short amount of words.
Sure. I am. Our goal is more practical writing than books.
Yeah.
And, you know, Ernest Hemingway famously won the Nobel Prize in Literature and the Pulitzer when he wrote Old Man and the Sea, which is sure, the fifth grade reading level, which is consistent with where you're going on that, Skip. Harvey, you were going to ask a question.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, on this is a lot of this podcast has to do with continuous improvement. And one of the things we like to talk about are learning and skills. And, you know, this method of writing more effectively, you know, it's a skill that you can practice. And to our listeners, tell us, other than reading the book, tell us about some other ways that they could go about if they wanted to improve their effective writing themselves, or if they wanted it for their organization, what are some ways that they can do that?
Great question. Okay. Starting at the most intensive is reading the book.
Sure.
The second, on the show notes, we'll have a one-page checklist. Below that, we'll also have a link to the AI tool, which is just I think of it with my students as a coach. It's just sort of like you can see, you only need it for a little while until you really get the intuition. But the simplest, and I think the big picture, is just internalizing this, which is that we are more likely to achieve our goals if we make reading for our readers easier. It helps us achieve our goals. It's also kinder to them because it takes less of their time and less of their limited attention and effort. It's also more inclusive. So another one of the things we talk about is the median reading level of a U.S. adult. And there are a lot of staff within the hospital that are not college graduates. The median U.S. adult reading level is ninth grade, meaning 50% of U.S. adults read at ninth grade reading level or lower. Many of our patients, for example, struggle to read complex sentences. And so when we write in ways that seem clear to us, but are a little complicated, not only is it less likely to achieve our goal and unkind to impose that burden on our reader, it's also inaccessible to a large fraction of them. So you ask, what's the big takeaway? The big takeaway is ask yourself, how do I make this easier for the reader? How do I make this easier for the reader? And the book downward to the AI tool are just ways to figure out how to do that.
And you guys, y'all do personal coaching. You do coaching for organizations that if they wanted to have a program for their entire staff.
Yes. I also do these workshops. I did one this morning. I did with a hospital chain. I've done it with several federal and state government agencies and private sector and whatever. I do these workshops on how to actually practice this and develop these capabilities. It's called, Writing for Busy Readers. And so we do it all the time. But so I guess we'll call that the most intense, then read the book, then but all these things. But I'm on the team, continuous improvement. A lot of it is really small, just improvements in process. And it's the lightest touch. It's not technical. It's not technological. It's not even organizational. It's like, well, so much of it ends at the very last stage, which is, do we successfully communicate with each other? And it turns out it's a little easier than you might think. To communicate more effectively, we should make it easier for the reader.
Sure.
You had a really practical comment there about the median reading at ninth grade or below in the United States. You know, my wife is a dyslexic therapist, and my daughter is dyslexic in addition to myself. And supposedly the statistics show that 25% of the folks there, one out of four is dyslexic. And I think that's such a practical mindset to say, listen, here's an audience, whether you like that or not, that is there. Here's their situation. If you want to get to them, if you want to communicate to them, then you have to think about how you're communicating. Right. And so I think this is so fascinating, especially in a day and age where we're doing all this texting and tweeting and what's been interesting to me since I listened to your podcast earlier, it's been fascinating to me. I've been more in tune. I couldn't wait to get you on this podcast, Todd, because one of the things I've noticed lately, and it may be a theme within the social media world, but I don't think I'm their target market, is I've seen all these long messages like on LinkedIn or all these long messages. And I'm thinking, really, is that reaching people? Because that instantly makes me go on. I don't take the time to look at it. So this is just so fascinating work.
You mentioned the cognitive science behind it. I'll be interested to see what the research shows. I mean, are our brains being hardwired differently from birth just because of the digital age? And my prediction is, yes, I think that's what they're going to find. But it is fascinating, Skip, as you said.
Yeah, and in the direction of this, Skip, with the long posts, I think the evidence is there may be an initial bump when we went from very short form to long form, like Twitter did this. They went from short form and then they allowed for longer form. A very initial bump where it's different and then people notice it. But in equilibrium, when things stabilize, I think the evidence is going to be like extremely confident. The evidence is in line with your practice and mine, which is skip, skip, skip. Not your name, but the activity. That said, we may have different goals. Again, like you can't write effectively without knowing your goal. I actually think some people like think about terms and conditions. I don't think that they or the disclosure when you get a drug from the pharmacy and they have the like 17 page whatever. The goal is to not be read. That's why they're written that way. And the goal for the pharma company is probably to be opaque. The goal for somebody posting on LinkedIn with 2,000 words, I think, is to show that they're serious. It's not really to be read. It's to signal something. But their goal isn't to be read, understood, and acted on, but to signal something is my prediction. And so, like, you could use these for, you know, less welfare improving ways to like conceal things and whatnot. But I'm focused, and I know you guys are, like, how do we communicate more effectively to improve all of our effectiveness? You continuously improve all of our effectiveness, whether it's communicating with staff, with our teams, to communicate with patients, to coordinate. Like we do it all the time and we don't do it perfectly. And it turns out there's a way to be better.
Well, this has been so fascinating, Todd. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this. I was so excited knowing that you agreed to come on the podcast. We really hope that you'll consider coming back again in the future. I think this behavioral science, the work that you're doing is just so important. I think there's so much to learn here. I just love this subject. I think this is so fascinating, the art and skill of how do we communicate. I love that you started off with, what are we trying to achieve? If we're trying to achieve, I want to communicate, then let's make sure we hold on to that anchor. So I just love what you're doing. And just so on behalf of Baptist Memorial Healthcare, thank you so much. I want to encourage all of our listeners to right now go out and pick up Writing for Busy Readers. Writing for Busy Readers. Really want to encourage you to do that. I know I'm going to be doing that. I'm looking forward to myself learning and how I can get better on this. But on behalf of Baptist Memorial Healthcare, thank you so much, Todd, for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. This has been fun. And thanks for the project you're on, which is trying to improve all of our effectiveness. We're on the same team.
Thank you, Todd.